just to discuss a different way of thinking about submanifolds rather than talking about boundaries of a manifold and how the action behaves. I wanted to just think more of submanifolds as actually being some sort of physical object or an approximation to a physical object. So, in other words, we come across objects which are effectively lower dimensional or approximately lower dimensional or actually treated as precisely lower dimensional. So, obviously, in string theory, you have objects that are either your fundamental string, which is two dimensional, or you have objects, D brains or Never-Schwarz brains, which have some dimensionality, which is less than the number of dimensions of space-time. And so thinking about these submanifolds or these brains as submanifolds is clearly an effective way to actually deal with their dynamics. So I'm going to start or give the most attention to an example which is called the domain wall. So codimension one, mainly because this is an example where you can go through everything analytically on the board. So here, I'm imagining that we have an object that is effectively one dimension down on the dimensionality of space. So how might you get one of these walls? Well, they often appear as vacuum defects. So we know when we study the standard model that we have typically hidden symmetries in our Lagrangian that get broken at our normal energy scales. So the standard mechanism is the Higgs mechanism, where the Higgs acquires a VeV and then changes the particle spectrum but is sort of refers to an underlying symmetry. So of course, Higgs's toy model was a model that had a U1 symmetry, but where the vacuum of your order parameter, your Higgs field, was not trivial. It wasn't a single point around which things were U1 symmetric. The vacuum was a circle which satisfies the U1 symmetry. But once you pick your vacuum, then your symmetry is broken and your particle spectrum changes. So that's an example where your vacuum is non-trivial. And when a vacuum is non-trivial, you end up with these things called vacuum defects. So, e.g., if you've got a ferromagnet, then you tend to get sort of your magnetism lining up in different domains. In fact, this is where the domain wall was. And in between the domains, there's a sort of, if you like, a disconnect, which has sort of higher energy than this mean state. So to describe this in space-time, here's my surface submanifold sigma. It's codimension one. So there's one direction orthogonal to sigma, and I'm going to choose coordinates that are called Gaussian normal So here, your z coordinate is like an extra, it's the proper distance from the wall. If you had a Euclidean signature, that would be the minimum. If you were going from a point to the wall, it would be the lowest distance. Because this is Lorentzian, it's going to be a saddle point in distance, but we kind of intuitively know what we mean by a normal distance to the wall. We set up a normal field on the wall, we geodesically extend it off the wall, and that is defining us the proper distance. And so our metric is going to have this format. So I'm going to take, because I want to think about what the gravitational field of one of these walls is, I'm going to just take gamma mu nu to be a function of x and compute the curvature. So this is a very specific choice of coordinates. I've got no cross terms in the metric, and I've got one coordinate just being the distance from the wall. And so in essence, what you're seeing is that the sort of parallel structure of this brain just scales as we move away into the bulk. So here's an example of our Cartan in action again. We define an orthonormal basis. Oops. Where I'm going to take I'm going to take an orthonormal basis purely in gamma, and then I multiply by A to get the orthonormal basis of my higher dimensional metric. So I compute my connection, d omega z is 0, d omega A is A prime dz cross omega naught plus A D omega naught. So from that, I can read off that theta A hat Z, so this is just omega Z, and this is just 1 on A, omega A hat. So I can just peel that off straight away. And then my AB components, well, this is just going to be the connection on gamma, right? So this term here is minus theta naught AB cross omega naught B. And then the A matches with the omega naught to give me an omega. So I've computed the connection. Now I want to compute the curvature. So remember that's the curvature two form is d theta plus theta wedge theta. So I take d of this thing. So I've just taken d of that first connection component. And then I have to add theta A hat B hat wedge theta B hat Z. But this is just A primed omega naught B hat. And so you see that this term and this term cancel. So that is one of my curvature two forms calculated. So I can rewrite this as minus A double primed on A omega A hat cross omega Z, which is going to tell me that my Riemann components are just A double primed on A. And then to get RAB, I have to take D of theta AB. So that's just D of theta naught AB. Then I have to take the cross terms. So that's theta A hat Z wedge theta Z B. And then I have to take the other cross terms. So you can see that this bit and this bit go together to give me R naught, the curvature two forms of gamma. Then for the other one, theta AZ is just A primed on A times omega A. And then for the other one, I want to get, first of all, I have to swap the ordering of my indices. So I first take, bring my index, my B index down. I swap the ordering, gives me one minus sign. I raise the Z, gives me another minus sign. So that is wedge omega C with another A primed on A. So that's completed calculating the curvature, and all I need to do is to read off what Riemann is from this. So the first term, remember, this is the curvature two form of the metric gamma. So it's a half R naught ABCD times omega naught C hat cross omega naught D hat. But these are omega naughts, not omega. So that's why the one on A squared comes in there. And then for the other bit, I've just got to match up my indices, which gives me delta A hat. I've swapped things around there. So this is what I get. So I've already computed the Riemann tensor of this metric in a few lines. So from this, I take the trace of Riemann to get Ricci, and I'm simply raising one index so that I can sort of take the hats off the index. I can go from orthonormal to coordinate. So I guess I wanted to do this for general dimension in part as an illustrative example of how useful Cartan can be, because in this case, you want to be agnostic about the dimensionality of your space-time. And that's kind of hard if you're using Mathematica, say, to calculate a curvature, because usually you have to specify the dimensionality of your space-time at the get-go. And therefore, in order to spot the pattern of how things depend on dimensionality, you'd kind of have to run it for several different values and then make a guess and check it for a few more. Whereas here, we've just done it from the get-go, and it really wasn't particularly complicated. So our Einstein equations, so the ZZ component, just like when you do spherical symmetry, your radial Einstein equation only has first order derivatives. This is kind of the same here. We only have first order derivatives of A. And then the mu nu Einstein equations, relate things to T mu nu. Yes.
I had a question about that metric up there. It seems like we have D minus one coordinates.
But no, we start mu as zero.
Ah, sorry.
It's like, you know, space time is 0, 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Yeah, I had to think when I was writing it down. I nearly wrote D minus one, and then I thought, nope, D minus two. Okay, so those are our Einstein equations. Now I want to actually sort of think about what that manifold looks like and what the T might be. If we just have a lower dimensional object, a brain, we really just expect our T to be highly localized. So our energy momentum of sigma should be highly localized around z equals zero, ideally a delta function. And the other feature of that is actually it shouldn't have any normal components, because if it's a truly lower dimensional object, it's just going to have energy momentum lying in those lower dimensional directions. So this is just thinking about what we might expect about our, our object. Now, for those that are interested, there is a sort of concrete example, several actually, is the kink, the phi to the fourth kink, which is a solution to your Lagrangian something. I may get the factors slightly wrong. So if you want to go away and read on these soliton solutions or topological defect solutions, that's an example. If you have that Lagrangian, you solve it in the probe limit, i.e. where it's not gravitationally back reacting, you can find an exact solution, analytic, which is a Tansch function. The Tansch function, you see, interpolates nicely between one vacuum, eta is minus one, minus eta, and the other vacuum, which is plus eta. So you go from vacuum one or vacuum minus to vacuum plus. And so this is analogous to that ferromagnet picture where you have a lowest energy state away from your object, but they're not the same lowest energy states.
Ruth, would you mind repeating one more time what this phi kink is?
So I'm just encouraging you to go and read a bit about it. This phi kink, I'm just saying this is an example of one of these solutions. So it's something that interpolates between two different vacua that are distinct. And in the middle, while it's in this region, and this region is characterized by a width that is order 1 over root lambda eta. So through a very small, potentially a very small region is where the field flips from one side to the other, and that's associated with a local energy density. And if you compute T mu nu for that analytic solution, you find that TZZ precisely vanishes, and T mu nu is just proportional to the metric. So this is an example of one of these solutions, which is an approximate submanifold. And so the reason why there was a lot of interest in these as submanifolds is if we have symmetry breaking transitions in the early universe, our knowledge of low temperature physics is that if you have something where your vacuum structure is non-trivial and you go through a relatively rapid phase transition, you get a lot, you get sort of disorder and you get these vacuum defects. So it's something that generically occurs. And so if, for example, we were to find cosmological evidence of one of these defects, we would immediately know far more about physics beyond the standard model than we could ever hope to access in colliders. So that's kind of the motivation, if you like, although we're not seeing anything, let's put it that way, so.
And how would someone experimentally find it?
Well, so that's why we need to know the gravitational effects of these things, because it's going to be through their gravity. Yeah. Things like lensing or, you know, if you get certain networks of these things, maybe they change the expansion history, impact on the microwave background, are there sort of discontinuities in temperature, these sorts of things. Yeah.
People have been looking for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you believe they exist?
That's a good question. So it's really interesting, actually, because I think the original hope of having these things at the grand unified scale is pretty much, you know, not looking very promising, shall we say, from the perspective of observation. But in terms of baryogenesis, some of the pictures of electroweak baryogenesis involve a sort of part, at least a weakly first order phase transition, and that's effectively where you get these walls. So people do study walls when looking about, you know, at the electroweak phase transition. But there, it's less about the gravitational effect, because by the time you're down to electroweak, you're well below the Planck scale. But there, it's more about how those walls interact with the environment. So, and then the other place that walls crop up is if you have vacuum decay. So if you have, for example, you know, if the Higgs vacuum is metastable, which again, I suspect is not very likely, but nonetheless, you know, that is, we're sort of very much on the borderline of vacuum metastability with the standard model parameters. Then if you have vacuum decay, you get one of these walls. You have a bubble of a different vacuum and a wall. So I think the sort of the general phenomenology of walls, you know, but without necessarily focusing exclusively on gravity, is still alive and kicking. But I think the original hope, you know, of getting some information on a grand unified theory, that's kind of, you know, fallen to the wayside a bit. So if I look at that very first equation and I say that the wall itself doesn't have a TZZ, then that already tells me something about A and R. I can't have A equal to 1, because if A was 1, that would be basically saying that this wall wasn't having any gravitational impact whatsoever. And that sort of seems rather unlikely for something that has an infinite energy. Because if I just naively say this wall has some energy density, unless I somehow make it compact, it has an infinite energy. And if I make it compact, then that's sort of, again, hand waving, that would mean that it was somehow localized, looking like a sphere, therefore I'd expect a sort of Schwarzschild solution. So there's no way that I really expect A to be equal to 1. Therefore, if I'm in vacuum, so this tells me that my sigma has some sort of curvature. So it's already telling me that gamma mu nu can't be flat. The only way gamma mu nu can be flat is if I somehow have a T, you know, I'm in a lambda universe. Okay. So let me just, again, for the sake of simplifying algebra, I'm going to set A of 0 to 1. Okay, so now I'm going to take gamma to be a constant curvature space. So you can actually justify all of these restrictions if you know something about the energy momentum, but I'm just going to cut to the chase and say this is what I'm assuming. So if gamma is a constant curvature space, then my R naught mu nu is equal to the trace of the Ricci tensor over 3 times gamma mu nu. Sorry, I'm also taking D equals 4 to simplify algebra. Take that. And d equals 4. Yep.
What happens if d equals 2 and the wall is like a line?
So if you go down, okay, so if you go below 4 dimensions, gravity ceases to be a propagating theory. So in 3 dimensions, gravity is just only, you only get space-time curvature where you have a source. And in 2 dimensions, the gravitational action, the R, is a topological invariant. So if you just have R, you don't actually, you know, really get any dynamics. So people doing gravity in 2 dimensions introduce a dilaton, so you have a phi R, and that way you can get some sort of interesting dynamics. But having a phi R is basically just saying you're dimensionally reducing from a higher dimension where you don't, you know, where you're sort of saying that there's a lot, you know, for example, spherical symmetry, because nothing happens in theta and phi. If you said no physics happens in theta or phi, you could reduce down to 2 dimensions, and then you would get like a phi R sort of effective theory in lower dimensions.
Wouldn't a defect in 4 dimensions be dimensionally reduced to a defect?
Yes, yes, it can be, absolutely, yeah. So then you have to figure out whether you're, you know, reducing parallel or perpendicular. If you're reducing parallel, it's quite straightforward. Reducing perpendicular is a bit different. So we will be talking a bit about dimensional reduction, I think, probably next time.
I just asked because of the d minus 2, because terms that would cancel, and I didn't know if it has any physical meaning.
Right, but okay. But I mean, in this case, we've got, you know, here we have, so our wall in 1 plus 1 dimensions would just be localized at a given point in space. So, and that R naught is, of course, the curvature of the sigma. So if you wanted to get down, that would be reducing across 2 dimensions within sigma. And let's see, and therefore, I think the A field probably would take on a different meaning. So looking at that, A would probably be more like the dilaton. I don't know, just have to think about it. Yeah, I think I'm not sure I would take this too seriously, dimensionally reducing, because, you know, because I've specifically not said what's happening within gamma. And so normally when you dimensionally reduce, you kind of look at, you know, what are the parameters associated with, you know, with your degree of freedom. If you dimensionally reduce on a sphere, you get a different result to dimensionally reducing on a torus. And so, yeah. Have to depend on the specifics. So if I now input this into my second Einstein equation, my Einstein tensor is just proportional to the metric, at least the gamma. So remember that G is A squared times gamma. So if you look at the R naught and this A primed on A squared for D equals 4, you see that is simply, you know, if you look here, this is 6 A primed on A squared is R naught. So that tells me that here, this term, R naught on 6, cancels with the a primed on a squared. And so all I'm left with is a relation between sigma and A double primed. So for a delta function, that kind of tells me that I have to have a jump. In A primed. So I can solve now for my metric function, for the delta function at least, exactly. And all it is just a sort of very simple profile. And of course, if I have some smoothed out core, it's just going to be where things happen within a very small radius. Yes?
Sorry, can you repeat your definition for sigma?
So sigma here was, sigma is T mu nu, it's proportional to gamma mu nu, and here it's sigma delta of Z. In general, it would be a profile, but a profile highly localized around z equals zero. So this solution here satisfies that A double primed is minus 4 pi g sigma times the delta function. And I could also, just as I'm going to want to do this, I'm going to write this as 1 minus mod z on L. And then that tells me that the value of my curvature So my constant curvature space I see is actually a de Sitter space-time.
Sorry, Ruth, when you say profile, let's say it's a profile, do you mean it's like a function that tells us what the brain or something looks like at z equals zero? Or?
Sorry, when I say what profile?
Sigma was a profile.
So the profile of the energy momentum. So sigma. Here is in this example, I'm saying sigma is a constant and it's all localized at z equals zero.
Okay.
But the real physical object might have obviously wouldn't be singular. It would be highly localized. And so, for example, for the kink, it's proportional to a sec to the fourth.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. But that is highly localized, right? So I'm just saying the delta function is a convenient limit, approximation where I ignore the detail of how you get from one side to the other side. And gravitationally, I see I can do that because this is a simple enough system. So what is this geometry? So away from z equals zero, I don't have any sort of delta function. So I'm going to look at z greater than zero. And I'm going to define two new coordinates. So as functions of z and t, which were my sort of original coordinates, Gaussian normal ones, then d tau squared minus d rho squared So if I define my tau and rho, sort of just splitting, you know, sharing the z and t dependence between them, when I look at just the flat line element, Minkowski line element, d tau squared minus d rho squared, I actually get what my solution is, a squared dt squared minus dz squared. So in other words, my metric is actually equal to d tau squared minus d rho squared minus rho squared d omega 2 squared. So this is flat space. So in other words, despite the fact this thing has all that energy away from my wall, I just get flat space. So let me just explore it a little bit more. Z equals zero, as I approach Z equals zero, my T is L sinh, my rho is L cosh. So I get rho squared minus tau squared is L squared. So that's a hyperboloid. So that's my surface, sigma. So now what happens for where, which side of sigma is z greater than zero? Well, if z is greater than zero, rho squared minus tau squared is L minus z squared, which is less than L squared. So this tells me that this direction is z greater than zero. So in other words, I have mapped the positive z side of my space-time into the interior of this hyperboloid. For z less than zero, I simply flip the sign of z so that I can identify again the factor pre-multiplying d omega squared with a radial coordinate, and we get the same picture. So I want to stress it's exactly the same picture. Our hyperboloid is again rho squared minus tau squared is L squared, but now this is z less than zero, is now again inside the hyperboloid. So you see that if z is negative, this decreases. So our space-time, our full space-time, actually consists of these two, where you simply match the two surfaces, the two hyperboloids together. So your, if you take a t equals constant surface, you see it's compact. It's a sort of distorted sphere. It's a bit like a burger bun. So it sort of looks like that. So as z goes to L, either plus or minus L, then you see that in the original picture, A went to zero. So you might have worried by the fact that that A function that I wrote down has a zero. You'd think, uh-oh, is there an event horizon? Well, it's not really an event horizon. What you have is the light cone of the origin. So let me get a different color.
Sorry, Ruth, why are we allowed to choose these row and channel?
We can do whatever we want with coordinates.
Is there a coordinate transfer?
Yeah. Flat? Yep. Which means the metric is flat. Mm-hmm. All I'm doing is I'm writing two, doing, you know, writing down a coordinate transformation, defining two new functions, and then when I look at them, I see that I've suddenly magically made my metric flat. And so now I'm just giving you a bit more of a sketch on the geometry. The geometry is actually just two hyperboloids glued together with the interiors kept. And what was A equals zero is just a light cone of the origin. And this is an acceleration horizon. So if you are a uniformly accelerating observer, you're asymptoting the speed of light, and there is a boundary beyond which you cannot see because you're constantly accelerating. And so for, if you're sitting on this wall here, you know, here, you cannot see beyond that past light cone, and you cannot influence what's happening over here. So you have an acceleration horizon. So that's kind of what's happening there. It's not a physical singularity. So I just wanted to finish off a bit by just considering a hyperboloid itself. As a submanifold. So in other words, if instead I had sketched that hyperboloid and looked at it as a submanifold, what might I have done? So my x mu is going to be t I want to do my x mu of t, theta, and phi is going to be the tau of So I take my hyperboloid, really is just defined by some relationship between t and rho, which I've written down there, and my normal to the hyperboloid. So obviously the normal is really just going to depend on, have a sort of t coordinate and a rho coordinate. And so I want really, I want my normal here to be d by dz, because that's telling me what my orthogonal direction is in terms of that original z coordinate. So if I go back to thinking about the language of submanifolds and calculate the extrinsic curvature, In this case, it is actually symmetric. I find k theta theta is just the connection components in the rho direction. So gamma rho theta theta gives me a minus rho. And then my n rho is cosh t on L. But substituting what? Hang on. Cosh t on L times rho. Substituting what my rho is, which is here. So this is L cosh squared t on L, which is minus gamma theta theta on L. Similarly, K phi phi, by exactly the same argument, is minus gamma phi phi on L. And then to calculate KTT, because T is an internal coordinate, I use this other way of writing the extrinsic curvature. By sort of flipping out, instead of projecting the covariant derivative of the normal onto sigma, I sort of swap what I'm differentiating. And so this is minus n tau x tau double dot plus gamma tau a b x dot a x dot b minus n rho rho double dot so that vanishes because there's no t dependence in the metric. And the only non-zero connection components are, of course, the standard spherical polar ones. So my T double dot, that's T, that gives me 1 on L sinh T on L. So that's the first bit times N tau. So even though I have non-zero connection components here, they're looking at the theta dot and phi dot components, but theta depends only on theta, phi depends only on phi, so there you go. So really, I'm just taking the second derivative of my t coordinate, tau coordinate, and rho coordinate. So that tells me that K is proportional to the metric, and the constant of proportionality is related to sigma. So I've related my extrinsic curvature on one side only to gamma and the tension. So if you remember, when I did the boundary term and looked at variations, I killed off something because I said by the rules of the Lagrange game, delta G was zero. But the thing that delta G was multiplying was, in fact, this combination. And so our wall, right, we can view it as an M minus, an M plus, and a boundary of M minus, and a boundary of M plus. So delta M minus has to be the same as delta M plus, so you're gluing things along an identical boundary, and then you have two normals, N plus and N minus. And so here, because our setup is exactly the same, our two curvatures are the same there. But of course, one normal is in the opposite direction. So here, this is something that can be confusing. So from so in other words, we sort of have that our Gibbons-Hawking term is giving us something like the integral of KAB minus KHAB, delta GAB, which is the same as HAB in our gauge. And then if we have a matter component, this, of course, if I vary it, is going to give me something like a TAB delta HAB if I have that on that surface sigma, which is the same as the boundary of M minus and the boundary of M plus. So these are the Israel equations. And you can see that you get here that because each of them are the same, I've picked up my 8 pi g sigma gamma ab, which is 8 pi g tab. So Israel actually wrote it as a difference in k. So he would have defined k plus ab to be defined with respect to n plus, but k minus ab would be equal to minus k of n minus. This is sort of the Israel k. But sometimes you might see it written as a sum of these two terms, in which case your normals are pointing in the opposite direction. So usually whenever, it seems like every time I do a calculation about these things, I have to just go back and check, because the sign of the normal is kind of a, you know, it tells you which side you're keeping, but it's really easy. It's just like the classic factors of two and minus signs are always plague you. But this is just sort of an illustration of how you can use this submanifold theory. Israel equations work whether or not your energy momentum is proportional to the metric. He originally developed them for looking at shells of dust. So that was a very different energy momentum tensor. And then just to leave you with some thoughts about brains more generally. You can have a far more, you know, you can have an arbitrary co-dimension brain in, you know, in essentially arbitrary dimensions. And so there's a nomenclature, which is that if you have the number of spatial directions on the brain. Is labeled as P quite often, so you have what is called a P brain. We all have P brains. So a zero brain is a particle, a one brain is a string, etc. So those are, that's just nomenclature, and usually in string theory at least, these are charged. So just like a particle couples to electromagnetism, and we would write that as a sort of integral of x dot mu a mu along the world line. Yep. If you have a string, the string couples to a b mu nu. Oh dear.
It happens all the time.
Wrecking the joint. So the string couples to a b mu nu, and this is like taking the integral of b mu nu dx mu dx nu on the world sheet, okay? So I think I'm going to stop there, although I did start late. And so this really gives rise to sort of thinking about the sort of equivalent of, you know, electromagnetism. You now have higher form charges, higher form field strengths, and you get also electric and magnetic solutions, which in four dimensions, you've just got a point particle being both potentially electrically charged as well as having a magnetic charge. So next time, I'd just like to sort of carry on with this theme of higher dimensions and talk about dimensional reduction.